Court appointed is meant to be for entertainment purposes and basic legal information only.
Nothing in this podcast should be considered as legal representation nor legal advice.
Only use the knowledge presented herein to dazzle your friends or possibly win bar trivia.
Dr. Lawyer, Indian Chief. For my life with songs of grief, with the yellow fear and fear aside.
Welcome to Court Appointed, on legal frivolity. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer dude and a judge.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am still just a dude.
We're back in the saddle.
Yeah, face to face, as it were.
I know.
I mean, I could see your face, but it was in that little picture on my phone.
That's true. It's kind of odd because we have not recorded in person in quite some time.
Yeah, I guess since March, huh?
That's right. But I will tell you, coming down into the podcast basement down here and slipping into the chair and doing the sound test, I feel like I haven't missed a beat.
Well, I know what you mean. Right back where we were. I guess we've been doing it long enough that it's nothing new about it.
We got enough episodes under our belts. Like, back to the same old rigmarole.
It'll be one less step for me in the editing process, make it a little bit easier.
Yeah, well, when we're getting ready to do it, I started wanting to count, one... Yeah. Two.
The way we get synced up with the two tracks. Now we got it all on one.
That's right. Don't need to merge them together.
Yeah, it makes my job easier.
Well, we had planned on doing this actually remotely, but I was driving home and thought, hey.
I'm closer to Tommy's house than mine.
Let's just swing over here and do it.
Rather than be 15 minutes late driving home and doing this, let's just stop by the house and do it.
That's right. So here I am in person, live. With you.
That's right. Well, the state's partway open back up, and, we're practicing social distancing and
we are
things like that. So,
yeah.
And I had a test recently, so I know I don't have it.
Yeah.
I had to have a test before I went and got my surgery.
Yeah, I have not had a test. I do not believe I have been exposed to it, so. But who knows?
Well, who knows?
But it seems like we're kind of getting back to normal a little bit here back in the state, in West Virginia at least.
Mm-hmm.
And
they had a headline in there today, new cases in Cabell County, or this was Sunday. Mm-hmm. New cases in Cabell County. I thought, oh, great, that doesn't sound good. And I read and it says, there was one new case yesterday and two more possibilities.
It's not too bad.
I know. That makes a headline? We must be desperate for news.
It's pretty quiet around here.
One new case and two maybes.
Yeah.
That's not exactly overwhelming the healthcare system.
So that has been dominating the headlines and also, all the protests that have been going on over the George Floyd death.
Yeah, and Black Lives Matter.
That's right. And we've had some protests here, but they've been peaceful and not contentious at all. Not like they're seeing in larger cities and things like that.
Yeah. Did you see the old guy last night that brought a mason jar filled with flour that was going to dump it on the Stonewall Jackson statue that they have at the Capitol?
I did not.
And the policeman said, that's defacing property. We would have to arrest you if you do that. So he said, well, I'm going to dump it out on the ground right here, and that will be by protest. So he dumped the flour on the ground near the statue, but it was in the grass. So I guess they weren't going to get him for dumping flour in the grass.
Well, I mean, how is that different than putting flour on a statue?
I don't know. Ends up in the same place.
I did not see that, but I did see there were some protests over that going on. So he was a Civil War general and fought for the Confederates. Mm-hmm. And, of course, back then, he was born in present-day West Virginia. But then it was Virginia.
Right.
And so he went with the Virginia military whenever they seceded from the Union and all that. Mm-hmm. And evidently he didn't think too much of West Virginia. He didn't think that we were actually a state. Didn't care for us much.
We weren't until partway through the war.
Well, but I'm saying even afterwards, he didn't care much for West Virginia doing what they did, is my understanding.
Well, we shouldn't have recognized them then. Speaking of Civil War, I saw something in the paper the other day that I couldn't believe.
What's that?
The last person in the United States that was receiving a Civil War pension died on May 31st.
I'm not even sure how that's possible. As you can see, I'm taking my shoes off and counting using every digit I have.
Here's how this happened. Evidently, this guy fought in the Civil War, and I think he was young, like 15, 16, and he started out on the Confederate side.
Okay.
And then he switched over, I guess, when he saw the tide turning, he switched to the Union side at the end, ended up over there. But anyway, his like second marriage, he fathered a child, and he was 84 years old when he fathered a child. And so this baby was born, and the baby was disabled. So since he was on his pension, the child also received a pension for its life because it was disabled for life.
Okay.
So then this child lived for 90 years. She didn't die till she was 90, but she was receiving this pension from the Civil War the whole time.
That's amazing.
I know. And it was only like $87.33, but still, just the fact that it's from the Civil War, they were still paying it.
Yeah. I guess they didn't really adjust that for inflation.
No, I don't think so. And they paid her in Confederate dollars.
Well, I'm not buying that. That's pretty strange. I can't remember what it was, but there's somebody who, some president, U.S. president, and he actually has like a, it's from a long time ago, and has a grandson or a great-grandson that's living. And it's just so, very strange because generationally you think it would be a lot farther down, mm-hmm. but it's one of those same situations where this person lived a really long life, had a child late in life. This person had a really long life and had a child late in life.
Yeah, I think I know what you're talking about. Yeah, I've heard that. I can't remember who it is right offhand, but it is somebody. Like it's like somebody from the Revolution or something like that. You know?
Yeah, like Thomas Jefferson or something like that.
Something like that. Yeah, I can't remember that.
Well, we thought this would be an interesting episode to do on martial law, given the fact that there are protests going on and some of them have turned violent and there's been looting and things like that. And then there's been some talk by the president and other, I guess, executives about imposing martial law. So what is martial law?
He's going to send in the military and bust heads and calm everybody down.
Well, there's a little bit of a difference there. That would be something a little bit different. Martial law is where there is some sort of executive order that comes through saying that you're not able to assemble in public and that there are a special set of circumstances in play at this time because of everything that is going on, all the civil unrest and things like that. It can also happen if there was if there was a coup or if like some foreign army invaded mm-hmm. our country or something like that, and there was a need to have martial law for
like
a very,
in Red Dawn.
Yeah, like in Red Dawn.
They instituted martial law.
They did. But I think that was the communists, the Soviets doing martial law on the Americans.
Right.
So, except the Wolverines, they fought.
That's right. Wolverines!
That was a great movie. And so the history of martial law, we've had it here in the U.S. from quite some time. It actually has its first happenings from before the American Revolution. And after the Boston Tea Party, the United Kingdom Parliament passed the Massachusetts Government Act, and that was what's called one of the Intolerable Acts, and made it so that town meetings and assemblies were illegal. So this was immediately after the Boston Tea Party. That was where the very first time that it happened here in the United States in recorded history like that.
But that was by the English passing that to keep us from meeting, wasn't it?
Exactly, because they wanted to suppress that.
They were suppressing us Americans.
That's right. And the reason why this is kind of important is because the right to assemble and the right to meet is one of the things that is guaranteed to the United States citizens by the First Amendment to the Constitution. It states that Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press or the right of people to peaceably assemble and to petition the government for redress of grievances. So this allows citizens to peacefully parade or gather, to demonstrate support or opposition of different public policy, and to express one's views. That's actually guaranteed in our Constitution. So that is one of the things that if you're going to declare martial law and say you can't meet, you can't protest, you can't do these things, you better have a pretty good daggum reason why you're doing it.
Yeah. I mean, I know that there was looting and some arson and things like that that took place, but I think that that was due to some bad actors. That wasn't the majority of the people that were there protesting.
Yeah.
That was some bad actors that were taking advantage of it, and, you know, whether they were a actual group that goes out and takes advantage of these situations. You know, they said there were people came in from other parts of the country. I don't know. You know, everybody has these conspiracy theories.
Yeah.
But what I saw, for the most part, people were marching and they had a reason to be out there. And the only thing that made it violent were the reaction of the police.
A lot of times, yeah.
And I don't understand that. How did the police quit being human and become something else? I mean, when you see them standing there, why don't they feel the same way we do? It can't be all the police are like, no, it's okay for us to abuse people's civil rights. You know, I don't believe that. I don't believe all of them are like that. So how do they all stand there shoulder to shoulder and do that? I mean, if it were me, I'd drop down my stuff and turn around and say, hey, I'm with you all.
Yeah. Well, I think there's a lot of dehumanization going on both sides. I think the police dehumanize the protesters. They don't actually see them as people with legitimate things. They're more about, this is their job, they're supposed to do these things, and regardless, they had the right to enforce these laws and rules upon people. I think that's how they're viewing it. And likewise, I think some of the protesters see the police as not as people with families and things like that. They see them as these militaristic type people who are trying to exert their will upon them, which rightfully so, because that's kind of our police forces have gone from becoming just Barney Fife patrolling the streets to needing tanks and, mm-hmm. and, you know, assault rifles and things like that.
Well, that's where all the military retired gear goes now, is to police departments. And that's where they're getting these flak jackets and helmets and all these kind of things.
I'm not saying we don't need to have SWAT and people that are armed in response to things that when mm-hmm. situations get really out of hand, but I don't think that needs to be the daily driver. You know, you should be in a squad car, not a tank, as your daily driver. That's just my two cents.
Well, and you were talking about dehumanizing. There was an article I read today about a policeman had gotten separated from the rest of the group that he was with. They basically got overrun by a bunch of protesters, and here was this cop realizing he was by himself, and the protesters started closing in on him. And as they were closing in, one of the protesters jumped in front of him and was like, no, leave him alone. And then two others came up and linked arms with him, till eventually about six of them, and these were all minorities, had linked arms to protect this white cop and not let people do anything to him.
I think that's also part of the plot of Police Academy towards the very end, whenever there's a riot.
Mm-hmm.
And Hightower's been thrown out of the police academy, and he's part of the protesters, and then he ends up protecting the other police officers, cadets.
I don't think that was the same plot going on there.
Well, it's similar.
But, you know, if the police really wanted to make a difference, instead of setting up these walls and trapping the protesters in the middle of the street, why didn't they line along the sidewalks along the businesses and just be there so that people don't firebomb the businesses or anything like that, you know?
Yeah.
And let the people, if they want to march up and down the street, let them march up and down the street. They're not hurting anybody doing that. They might block traffic a little bit, but they're not hurting anything. Protect the businesses. That's what they should be there doing. They shouldn't be there getting in a position to militarily, strategically confront the protesters coming. The protesters aren't going to do anything. They just want to march. They just want to be heard.
Yeah. Well, there's a history of that goes back a little bit farther than the U.S. Constitution about people's right to assembly. And it's actually some states' rights that guarantee it as well. And I want to talk about that. But before that, I think there actually is a motion before the court today.
Why, yes, if it pleases your honorship, we would like to approach the bench to pay court costs.
All right. Hear ye, hear ye. Who do we have on the docket?
We have a brand new advertiser with us, and one we're proud to have aboard. Their name is Storyworth.
Finding the perfect gift for your dad can be really tough.
Really tough.
Especially when you don't have the luxury of celebrating Father's Day in person because of social distancing and the inability to travel to and fro.
I know that more than anything, parents cherish spending time with family. That's why I'm giving my dad the most meaningful gift this year, a chance to connect with loved ones through Storyworth.
So you might ask yourself, what is Storyworth? Storyworth is a fun and meaningful way to engage with family, especially with relatives you might not get to see too often.
It's an online service that helps your loved ones share stories throughout thought-provoking questions about their memories and personal thoughts. It's the gift of spending time together wherever you live.
Every week, StoryWorth emails your family member different story prompts, questions you've never thought to ask, like, what have been some of your life's greatest surprises, and what's one of the riskiest things you've ever done?
I could answer some of the riskiest things I've ever done have involved you, Tommy.
Well, that's true. I probably talked you into them.
Whether it was going down a hill on a sled or jumping a bike over a ramp, they were very risky.
But I didn't have anything to do with the sled. I was chasing after you.
Well, you know. Reading the weekly stories is fun and makes family feel close, even if we can't all be together.
After 1 year, StoryWorth will compile every answered question and photo you choose to include into a beautiful keepsake book that ships for free. My family will treasure this book forever.
So they take all the stories from all the different questions you've answered, put it into a big book, put some pictures in it, and then you have a nice family heirloom and a keepsake.
StoryWorth is a great way to stay in touch with your family and helps bridge geographic distance by providing lively discussion topics.
And here's the cool thing. You can email your loved one's StoryWorth subscription directly to them so they can access it and activate their account at any time. Whether you schedule the email in advance or share immediately, it's the perfect gift when you can't go shopping or meet in person. And there's no rush. They can take their time and fill it out when they need to.
So if you're struggling for something for your dad for Father's Day, give him the most meaningful gift this year with StoryWorth. You can get started right away without the need for shipping by going to StoryWorth.com/court. You'll get $10 off your first purchase.
That's StoryWorth.com/court for $10 off.
So start your story today.
That's kind of fun, us like sharing our own stories back and forth there.
Yeah, we'd have a book full, that's for sure.
That would be one you would probably read while sitting on the toilet.
I get that for my dad, and my dad is like, one of the questions would probably be like, what do you know about our ancestors? Well, they were horse thieves from St. Louis. That's all I've ever gotten out of him. I don't know anything beyond his mom and dad. That's about it. And all I got after that was they were horse thieves out of St. Louis.
That's a good backstory.
Yeah, I guess so. I never got any details on it, though.
So I did say that states had different Declaration of Rights, and one of the earliest ones with regarding to the right to assemble was in 1776, and this was Pennsylvania's Declaration of Rights. They were the first state to actually recognize that right. And here's kind of an interesting little tidbit about that. So 1670, William Penn, he was the founder of Pennsylvania. So Penn, Pennsylvania.
And the fountain pen?
I don't know about that. While in London, he was arrested on Gracechurch Street for giving a sermon to a group of Quakers in the street in front of his church. London officials had locked the hall and forbidden him to preach in any building, so he took his sermon to the streets, and he was charged with unlawful, tumultuous assembly that disturbed the king's peace. The judge in the case tried to force the jury to return a verdict of guilty for William Penn, and it was a really bad memory for him. And so that is one of the interesting things about why Pennsylvania had the first guaranteed right to assembly, because the founder of that, Pennsylvania, was actually charged with that when he was a resident of London.
Hmm. So that must have been what the Doobie Brothers were singing about. Taking it to the streets.
Yeah, I was drawing a blank there. Which song are you talking about here? So we do have a very strong right to assemble here in the United States. It's something that's guaranteed. It's embedded in our DNA, I think, as Americans. Like, hey, we have the ability to be able to see each other and talk about things that bother us. I mean, it's our history. The Boston Tea Party, we're a bunch of rabble-razzlers. So that's the way it is. But the right to assemble is not an absolute. There are certain restrictions that the government can impose on it. But they can't simply prohibit public assembly without any kind of a good reason on it. They can impose restrictions on time, place, or manner of a peaceful assembly, provided that constitutional safeguards are met. Time, place, and manner restrictions are permissible so long as they are justified without reference to the content of the regulated speech and narrowly tailored to serve a significant governmental interest and leave an open alternative channels of communication for the information. So you can't just protest anywhere. You can have time, place, and manner restrictions as long as they are narrowly tailored to meet a specific government interest. That's a very important distinction there.
Mm-hmm.
Because whenever you are looking at the narrowly tailored, what you're talking about is laws that are going to be strictly scrutinized. And strict scrutiny is the highest level of constitutional review that we have in the United States. There's different levels, and I'm going to talk about those in a little bit. We've talked about those before.
Yeah, you talked about that, about things that come before the Supreme Court.
Yeah, and that is the, whenever you're talking about constitutional issues, there's different kinds of basis for reviews for those. Mm-hmm. And strict scrutiny is the hardest one to meet. And that is for anything that is a guaranteed fundamental right. If you're going to infringe upon that guaranteed fundamental right, you have to pass that test.
You better have a good reason.
Exactly. Now, this time, place, and manner doctrine was first set forth in the U.S. versus O'Brien, which is a 1968 case. As long as people peaceably convene to picket, protest, or distribute handbills, the state may not penalize the assembly. The protection does not mean that the government is not able to apply restrictions for health, safety, and welfare designed to protect private property, eliminate litter, curb visual blight, facilitate traffic, control noise, or minimize congestion.
Or practice social distancing.
Or practice social distancing, which I don't understand how that's that's flying at all.
The only thing I can say is there's a lot of them, I'm sure they didn't mind wearing a mask.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, they were in close proximity, so it's a good thing they did. But I also feel like a lot of them felt like, well, just in case anything goes south, I'm glad I've got my face covered.
Now, the other thing I said is that it has to be narrowly tailored. There was a case called Shuttlesworth versus Birmingham from 1969, and This struck down a ordinance about parades that conferred upon the city commission unbridled and absolute power to prohibit any parade, procession, or demonstration on the city streets or public ways. So if you're looking at the narrowly tailored, that is not a narrowly tailored law. That is very broad.
It covers a lot of things.
And it was struck down. The important thing we have to remember about these guaranteed fundamental rights is that we might not even like some of them, the ramifications of them. The one that always comes to mind is the National Socialist Party versus Skokie. That's the case. Yeah. The 1977.
The Klan wanted to march through, what was it, Indiana or Illinois?
Illinois. It was a 1977 U.S. Supreme Court case, and they were not, they might have been KKK, but it was the Nazis.
Nazis, that's what it was, yeah.
So essentially in that case, the Supreme Court held that even though they wanted to march through a predominantly Jewish part of town, that they were allowed to do it based upon the fact that you can't really restrict freedom of speech like that. Mm-hmm. So it's very hard to kind of justify that and understand that. And you want to say, no, you shouldn't be able to do that. But at the same time, if we're going to have a broad application of this, I think we have to have a broad application of it. You can't really split hairs.
Otherwise, you're censoring things because you don't like it. And yeah, that's what contrary to the Constitution. So it's
right.
You know, it's like I've heard the thing before. I may not like what you're saying, but I'm going to defend your right to say it.
Yeah.
So,
and I think that comes into a lot of problems. And, you know, I'm sure there's some people that are listening to this podcast as well, this episode, will think, well, that's just silly. Everybody can agree that Nazis aren't good, but I don't know.
There is a thing that they have gone into now. And I don't know if it's clearly defined or defined enough, but it's hate speech.
Well, yeah, hate speech is not protected.
And that's what I mean. And so, you know, when you say, what's the problem with Nazis march through there? There's just a group with their belief. If their belief is you need to kill other people or other people aren't of the same value that we are, that's hate speech.
Yeah.
And so, therefore, it should be eliminated.
Well, the reason why hate speech is not permissible and doesn't have protections is because it has no redeeming value.
It's like yelling fire in a movie theater. It falls under the same thing, if you ask me.
We think that free speech has redeeming value pretty much always. If it's hate speech, though, no redeeming value, not protected. And that's the analysis that essentially we look at when we're doing that.
Same way it should be with political advertising when they have all those negative ads. That's just hate speech.
Now, there has been some more constitutional infringement upon the right to assembly via martial law and other cases, too. During the War of 1812, Andrew Jackson imposed martial law in New Orleans during the Battle of New Orleans. I think we talked about this before.
I've sung that song before.
What song's that?
The Battle of New Orleans.
Oh, was that from a play?
No. It was an old song. It was popular when I was a kid.
Back in 1812 when you were a kid?
Yeah. Yeah, it was a fun song.
This was the instance where actually he had martial law, Andrew Jackson, and he suspended the writ of habeas corpus. Remember us talking about that. Mm-hmm. And so therefore a judge overruled that and said, you can't do that. And rather than comply with it, he had the judge arrested. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
We talked about that in the previous episode.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So that's a little scary. Mm-hmm. President Lincoln actually imposed martial law back in 1863 and suspended habeas corpus throughout the entire U.S. And he imposed suspension on prisoners of war, spies, or aiders and abettors of the enemy, as well as other classes of people, such as draft dodgers. And that was actually challenged in a case, and the Supreme Court held that his imposition of martial law by the suspension of habeas corpus was unconstitutional in areas where local courts were still in session. So, and that's still good law. So you can't just do away with the court system if you want to, because it's martial law.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was one time where old Abraham Lincoln, who has a pretty clean record, didn't really come out on top.
Well, but he suspended habeas corpus though, so that people couldn't get slaves that had escaped from the South and petition them to come back.
Well, that's true. Yeah.
I mean, in other words, you know, that may have been struck down, but he did it for a very valid reason.
That's true. The other time was the Great Chicago Fire of 1871. The Chicago mayor, Roswell Mason, declared a state of martial law and placed General Philip Sheridan in charge of the city on October 9th, 1871. When the fire was extinguished and there were no more widespread disturbances, martial law was lifted after a few days. But in a state of emergency like that, after a huge fire, it was probably appropriate to have martial law.
Right. Well, they were there more to help. That's like when the military comes in after a hurricane or something like that. You know, you want them there then.
Well, to a certain degree, but whenever you have instances like that, there are going to be people who take advantage of the situation, like you said, and would go out and try to rob from people and steal and things like that. So that's an important thing. And they have that during...
Yeah, and the police can't manage that because the police, they live wherever this disaster took place. And so they have more to take care of than what they can take care of. So
yeah.
You bring in the military to help out.
Another time martial law was declared, it was here in West Virginia.
Oh, yeah. Was that during the Blair Mountain battle, Battle for Blair Mountain or something?
It was during the Cold Wars in 1920 and 21.
Yeah.
Our Governor Cornwell, asked for federal troops to be dispatched to Mingo County to deal with striking miners.
Yeah, them miners are tough. They don't like it when you don't want to pay them and stuff like that.
They are. And when you want to pay them in company money so they can't spend it other places.
And they finally decided enough was enough.
That's right. And a lot of the miners were arrested without any real reason and then released later without even being charged. They were just kind of...
They were just arrested for being miners.
Pretty much, yeah. So there have been a lot of instances of martial law in the United States, and there's an ancient Roman law which forbade any general from crossing the Rubicon River and entering Italy with their standing army. And part of the reason for that was because to do so would be considered an act of treason, and it was actually you were able to be tortured and put to death if you did that under Roman law. And the purpose of the law was to protect the Republic from internal military threat.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that principle has kind of been handed down and ingrained in our society as well. We don't really want federal U.S. troops on our own land marching against its own citizenry.
Mm-hmm.
That is not a good situation.
It reminds me of that statement that kind of got Biden in some hot water here not too long ago, but then it's... Funny how things come to pass. Funny, ironic, not funny, haha.
Yeah.
When he said something about somebody was telling him about their right to own an automatic weapon so they could defend themselves against the U.S. military should the U.S. military get out of line. And Joe just laughed at him, and he said, you're going to get out there with your AR-15 or whatever it is and go up against a F-35 that's, you know, coming by and dropping bombs on you, you know, good luck.
Yeah.
If the military wants to take you out, they're going to take you out. You don't have, you know, as a civilian, you don't stand a chance.
Well,
you don't want to hear a guy running for president saying, the military can take out all our people. But then we turn around with a situation like right now.
Yeah.
You say, this looks suspect.
Well, the military didn't take out the Wolverines in Red Dawn.
No, they didn't.
Actually, check. Take that back. They did eventually.
After a while.
Spoiler alert.
Well, short of martial law, there was a couple of things that I found along the same lines. It said, tracing back to the Magna Carta, the British Charter of Liberty signed in 1215, there's a longstanding tradition against military involvement in civilian affairs. However, the U.S. Constitution guarantees that the national government will protect the states in times of violence and permits Congress to enact laws that enable the military to aid in carrying out the law. Almost immediately after the Constitution's enactment in 1787, Congress passed a law that allowed the president to use the military to respond to a series of citizen rebellions. Troops serving as what's called posse comitatus, which translates roughly to attendants with the capacity to act, could be called to suppress insurrections and help carry out federal laws. Following the Civil War, the national government used troops in this capacity to aid in the Reconstruction efforts in the South.
I think that initial time was during the Whiskey Rebellion, if I remember correctly.
Well, it was also citizens rebelling against taxes.
Well, I think that was
federal
part of it.
Taxes and stuff, yeah. Well, the Whiskey Rebellion, that's what that was, a federal tax, yeah. So that was what they had to have them. The use of troops in this manner may even have influenced the outcome of the 1876 presidential election of Republican Rutherford B. Hayes. That happened when, in return for agreeing to withdraw federal troops from the South, Democrats informally agreed to the election of Hayes when the disputed election was thrown into a congressional commission. 2 years later, Hayes signed into law the Posse Comitatus Act, which prohibited the use of military in civilian manners. The Posse Comitatus Act, we'll just call it the PC Act. How about that?
Okay.
Act has not changed much since that time. The law prohibits the use of military in civilian matters, but over time, Congress has passed at least 26 exemptions to the act that allowed the president to send troops into states. For example, the examples range from providing military personnel to protect national parks to helping states in carrying out quarantine and health laws. Now, if Trump wanted to use a military law, put the military in, he would likely rely on the Insurrection Act, which governs certain circumstances when the president can use military. It was signed by Thomas Jefferson in 1807. Over time, the law has evolved to allow the use of troops in other circumstances. For example, Presidents Eisenhower, Kennedy, and Johnson used the Insurrection Act in the 1950s and 60s to send the military to enforce court desegregation orders and to protect civil rights marchers. It was last invoked by President H.W. Bush in 1992 when he ordered 4,500 troops to Los Angeles after rioting erupted in response to the acquittal of police officers charged with beating Rodney King. The Insurrection Act says that the president may use armed forces to subdue an insurrection or rebellion and take such measures as he considers necessary to suppress violence. So, the main sticking point is, you know, most people will contend that the governors have to make that call. The federal government can't force troops into an area without the governor of that state asking for that support. And whether that's the way it would actually be followed or the way it's actually read, I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of times things are being done anymore these days that are not what most of your political scholars would tell you is the way it's supposed to do, but it gets done that way anyway.
Yeah. I know Trump has threatened that, and he said that he would use that or whatever, but the way that it works, it's kind of a two-step process. The first being that the president has to publish a proclamation ordering the insurgents to disperse, mm-hmm. and there's not been any kind of proclamation or anything like that that has been announced. So mm-hmm. I don't think that's going to be something that he's going to do right now. I mean, who knows later on, but I think he stopped short of making a proclamation and said, hey, I might use this. But I, you know, I don't know that people paid attention to that, to be quite frank with you. I don't know that people really listen to what he has to say at this point.
Well, I mean, if you ask me, he had an opportunity here to make a big positive change and a big positive difference.
Yeah.
He could have met this whole thing with a lot different attitude. And I think he would have been better off to just to act like we're just going to roll all you people over and we're not going to listen to you. That's not going to make them go away.
No, and that's un-American.
I mean, it's just...
I mean, it really is.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of people that are outraged, and out there. And it's amazing to me. The numbers keep growing. I thought after that first weekend, everything would drop off, but the numbers just keep growing.
Yeah.
And I mean, the only thing I can think is there's an awful lot of people that are unemployed right now. So they're not missing their jobs. They don't have any jobs to lose, or they've already lost their jobs. They've got nothing else to lose. So they're able to go out and participate in these things.
You know, and this just happened yesterday. I saw it. I don't know if you read this or not, but the Minneapolis City Council they voted to disband the police department.
Right.
I'm not sure exactly how that's going to play out.
Yeah. Well, I was reading about what do you do in lieu of a police force. There are places and times in history where cities or areas have managed without a police force.
Right. But I mean, I imagine a major metropolitan area. Are they trying to move more towards like the British model where they're more safety officers, where they don't carry guns and things like that?
Yeah, and you move a lot of the money over to public programs.
Yeah.
For education and economic development and stuff like that. Things that instead of just arresting away the crime, you give people an alternative to crime.
Yeah.
And so they're moving more towards that. And police forces just altogether have to be retrained.
Yeah.
And it can't be tolerated that anybody is allowed to do any of these things. I mean, somebody getting killed like George Floyd was, that's for every instance where somebody dies, there's probably 100 others where somebody was just harassed but didn't die, you know? And there had to be other officers that were there that turned their head or didn't say anything or lied for the guy.
Yeah.
So until every one of them says, we're not going to let that be acceptable, we're not going to protect you, that's the only way it's going to go away.
Yeah.
I mean, with our current police force, the way it is, unless there's some kind of real big changes involved, I don't have any answers. I don't know what the answers are, but something's got to change. Something's got to be fixed.
I agree. Well, that's going to bring us to
Legal Breeze. You see that? We synced up perfect on it when we're sitting in there. That's the first time we... It was, none of the other ones were good. I was ashamed of every one of our legal briefs there on the other
show. I know.
This one worked just right.
I know. It's like we're back in action again.
Yeah.
So Legal Briefs is the part of the show where I ask Tommy different legal questions and see if he remembers them. But before we get started, we thought it'd be appropriate to take a moment of silence for everything that's going on in the country and for George Floyd and for all the protesters and everything that's going on. I'm really concerned for our country. I hope we can heal these divides. It's a sad state.
Thoughts and prayers are not enough. Sending thoughts and prayers. We need action.
That's right. All right. So on to the quiz, Tommy.
All right. I'm ready. As ready as I'm going to be.
The first question. What is strict scrutiny?
Strict scrutiny means it has to be narrowly defined and has to be very specific in nature so as not to overreach or be too broad.
And what triggers strict scrutiny?
Anything that's on a constitutional level.
That is it. Okay, so strict scrutiny is whenever a fundamental right is impinged upon. And if you're going to have a constitutional analysis of it, and it's a fundamental right, it's going to be subjected to the strict scrutiny test by the Supreme Court.
Okay.
And the strict scrutiny test, that has to be, and this is the two key things, a compelling government interest that is narrowly tailored to meet those interests. So
if you're going to infringe on the Constitution,
you better have a good reason, and you better do it
narrow.
And
succinct.
Exactly.
All right.
And that's the highest one. And it's very hard for laws to survive strict scrutiny. Historically speaking, whenever you're arguing constitutional law, really the battle comes in about, is it a fundamental right or not? Because once it's determined to be a fundamental right, you have to meet that high standard. It's really hard. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the jockeying comes in to determine whether or not it's a fundamental right or not. And some things are not expressly stated in the Constitution as a fundamental right. And so there, that leads it up into interpretation about whether or not it is. And that's where the real argument comes in, because once something is determined to be a fundamental right and it's subject to strict scrutiny, it's a foregone conclusion that it's going to fail. You can almost look at it that way.
All right.
So the other test is, do you know what that one's called?
Probably, but I've forgotten.
I don't know that I actually mentioned it in this episode. I think I definitely said the words, but I did not mention that it was the test. Oh. It is the rational basis test.
Oh, okay.
And the rational basis test is much lower standard, and the law, it has to be determined not unreasonable or arbitrary, and it is rationally related to a legitimate state interest. So,
all right.
Let's see where that standard is a little bit lower. You still have to have a good reason why you're doing it, but it doesn't have to be compelling, and it doesn't necessarily have to be narrowly tailored. Though, if you're going to write a law, you should narrowly tailor it anyway, because that's just a good way to write laws.
It should be very specific, so it doesn't get misinterpreted or have to be constantly reinterpreted.
That's right. And the last question is going to be a bit of a history question.
All right.
And I talked about an old Roman law and the army. What was that?
They weren't allowed to bring the army across some river into Rome, or else they would be considered traitors.
That's right. And that's when Caesar did that. He crossed the river Rubicon. Yeah. And once he crossed the river Rubicon, he said that, you know, the die was cast. There was no turning back at this point, because that was when he was really fully committed.
He had to be.
That's right. So, but that's when Rome changed from a republic, and it changed to kind of a dictatorship, or whatever you would call that.
Caesar was a dictator.
Yeah, whenever Caesar was there. So that was definitely a change in Roman politics at that point. So yeah. I don't want our country to cross the river Rubicon.
No, I don't either. We were talking about the Battle of New Orleans and that song you said you'd never heard.
Uh-huh.
There was a guy that I used to hang out with. We'd play ping pong during the summer, and he had these kind of novelty records, and so it had some funny songs. One of them was Snoopy and the Red Baron,
mm-hmm.
and then the other one was the Battle of New Orleans,
huh.
And it was the refrain that was the catchy part that you always heard was, "We fired our guns and the British kept a-coming. There was about as many as there was a while ago. Fired once more and they begin to running down the Mississippi to the Gulf of Mexico."
Thanks to everybody for listening, and thanks to MCRB for use of their song, Dr. Lawyer Indian Chief.
We're proud to be coming to you almost live from Smurl Studios, high atop Three Last Mountain.
And we want to thank Audio Boom for being a part of their network.
And we also want to thank the McElroy Stable of Podcasts for helping give us our start. Their podcasts include Mabim Bam, Sawbones, Still Buffering, and many other fine offerings.
If you have the chance, take the time to rate and review us on iTunes, especially if you like us. And if you didn't, don't bother.
You're not supposed to say that.
You're going to edit that out though, aren't you?
Why? You never did.
Thanks for listening. This has been Court Appointed. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am just a dude. Hello, and welcome to Tommy's Random Thought. Today's random thought is, what happened to the pandemic? I don't think we got a vaccine, at least as far as I know, but I guess the pandemic went away. Newspapers and TV stories have been dominated by COVID-19 and and updates about COVID-19. We shut down the country and put people out of business and out of their homes for this terrible disease infecting our entire country. But on about Wednesday, May 27th, the pandemic was over. It seems that we finally figured out that we have a worse problem. It didn't just shove the coronavirus pandemic to the back page, but right out of the paper altogether. This problem is just as stealthy as COVID-19. However, it is more visible. Sometimes it is subtle. Sometimes it is offensively obvious. But it is always pervasively there. This disease affects the mind and subjugates fellow human beings to a lower class. It devalues their very lives. When COVID-19 was identified, we made big plans to isolate and shut down and ramp up manufacturing of needed supplies and all these things to save the lives of innocent Americans. We wrecked our economy, shuttering some businesses for good and some people losing their homes and jobs and pretty much everything. But it was worth the sacrifice, we were told. Where is this planning and need to sacrifice when we are confronted with blatant racism? While there are many examples through history, just starting with Rodney King should have been enough for us all to take notice, but much the same as mass shootings, we send thoughts and prayers and nothing changes. The list from Rodney King to George Floyd and all the similar murders in between is a stark indictment of our justice system that does not treat African Americans the same as white Americans are treated. Have we finally gotten that message? God, I hope so. Then we treat these unarmed, innocent men much like we used to treat rape victims. How were you dressed? Had you been drinking? You know, all those questions that say, yeah, she was asking for it. We finally figured out that was wrong. But we do the same thing to gun down African American men. He had a record. He had drugs in his system. He was in a bad neighborhood. He didn't comply with unreasonably vague requests of the officer. Oh, then he deserved to die over $20. The news built up all the COVID-19 stuff, and we couldn't get enough of it on TV. You couldn't watch TV without it being on. I mean, every governor thought he had to be giving a daily update and broadcast. Now, we are all broke, except for that same 1% that quarantined on their yachts in the Caribbean, and we still have over 100,000 dead. We had over 100,000 die from the Asian flu back in 1968, with our troops coming back from Vietnam, and no one really said much about it or did anything about it. And since we didn't have a 24-hour news service on TV or the internet, it just didn't get that much notice. So maybe if they had all just kept their mouth shut, we probably would have ended up about the same anyway, but we would at least still have our homes and jobs. Thanks, government and news people. This disease is just the opposite, though. It needs to have a lot of talking. It will be uncomfortable conversations because they need to be about race. And no one wants to talk about race. But we are all a member of some race, so it is a fact we need to deal with, not ignore. I hate that saying, I don't see color. If we are honest, we will acknowledge we do see color. It's what you do with that recognition that matters. This is a cause that we need sacrifice and to have difficult conversations and actually fix things. Then when it is all over, instead of looking at the carnage and the loss, we can embrace the growth and improvement for everyone, not just the privileged few. So yes, one pandemic went away overnight without a vaccine, but we have a new pandemic that gets deeper inside all of us than a mere virus. This pandemic is what will define us as Americans, and if we can do the hard stuff to make this a better country for all. This has been Tommy's Random Thought.